What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
The new Wegovy pill is now available through Weight Watchers. Powerful GLP-1 results in a simple pill at the lowest price available. And with Weight Watchers, you can get doctor support and personalized nutrition programs. See if you qualify at WeightWatchers.com. Ad not reviewed or approved by Novo Nordisk.
Hi, guys. Welcome to the Katie Halper Show. On today's episode, I play an interview that I did live at McNally Jackson, a bookstore in Soho, where I interviewed Jeff Halper, no relation that we know of at least. I'm sure listeners are very aware of the attacks on Ilhan Omar. And in fact, I appeared on Fox News to defend her, and I'll be releasing that audio along with an interview that I did with Adam Johnson about the media's representation of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and of the Ilhan Omar story, and also of the Jewish voice and the way that the media represents a Jewish voice as if it's a monolith. But something that Ilhan Omar's comments have both obscured and highlighted is the role of AIPAC. It's obscured it because people are trying to stifle any criticism of AIPAC as anti-Semitism. But it's also, of course, forced people to look at it to some extent. But what's interesting is that while, of course, AIPAC does have a very outsized role in American foreign policy and in American support of Israel, there are other factors that cause Israel to receive such unquestioning and unwavering support from nations, including but not limited to the United States. And that's something that Jeff Halper thinks and writes a lot about. He's an American-born Israeli anthropologist and director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. He's the author of Obstacles to Peace and Israeli and Palestine and War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification, which was shortlisted for the Palestine Book Award, and he was nominated for the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize. Jeff and ICAHD are currently involved in a joint Palestinian-Israeli grassroots initiative, the One Democratic State Campaign, ODCS. And in this chat, you'll hear some questions from the audience members. And one of them is Stephen Sheehy, who's a professor of Middle Eastern Studies at William and Mary. And another one comes from Lara Sheehy, who is a psychologist and professor of psychology at George W. You can always support The Katie Halper Show at patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. And dropping soon will be a bonus episode with Adam Johnson, where we talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict's representation in the media and the Ilhan Omar controversy.
Thank you so much, everyone, for coming. Thank you so much, Jeff, for coming to talk to us. We are, again, as far as we know, not related. But one of the things that I find really interesting, and we've met before, and we went around, I don't even remember where you were, but I watched you talk about the stuff that you're now writing about more, like the science of security, and all these nano arms and things that someone like you and someone like me are not naturally interested in. But you have done the work for the rest of us who aren't engaged and don't use that side of our mind. What is that, the right or the left side? See, I don't even know which side it is. Anyway, the math science side. And before we get into that really important discussion, which is basically looking at why people are so supportive of Israel, I wanted to just give people the chance to learn about why you wound up in Israel in the first place. And you told me something once about how, as someone who studied anthropology, there were only a few, or maybe one place that you could go to not feel like a neo-colonialist.
Ah, I see what you mean. No, I did feel like a neo-colonialist.
Oh, okay, to feel
without
less
without
like
the
one.
Neo.
Right.
You know, everybody has a biography, and everybody makes decisions. And I was very involved in the 60s. I'm kind of a museum piece. You know, I'm like the Forrest Gump of the 60s. I grew up in Hibbing, Minnesota with Bob Dylan. I was in the anti-Vietnam War movement. I was a draft resister. I was in Mississippi with the Civil Rights Movement. I was at the Chicago Convention in 1968. I was at Woodstock by chance, but I was at Woodstock. I did everything you were supposed to do except hate Ashbury. And when the 60s collapsed and we got Nixon and neoliberalism, I just felt I wanted, maybe if I'd lived in New York, it would have been different. Because here there's some substance. In the Midwest, in the 70s, under Nixon, it's pretty flat, pretty thin. And I really didn't feel, that there was much here for me. And I wanted to go, like Katie says, I wanted to go somewhere where I could be politically active. And we called it in those days another front in the revolution. And because I'm Jewish, so I was able to go to Israel, not for good reasons, for colonial reasons, but because of that, I had the right to go in a sense, not the right to go, but in Israeli sense, a right to go. And I could be a part of the society and I could be active. And I felt that arena was more meaningful. And there was a certain, in those days in the 60s, we forget about it a little bit, but there was an identity politics a little bit, not as aggressive as today, but you had Alex Haley's Roots. So the African Americans were like the first community to sort of legitimize, ethnic backgrounds and so on, instead of the melting pot idea that had been. And then you had the Native American movement and you had Cesar Chavez, and I got caught up in that, but I'm not religious in any way. And that's why I'm saying if I'd lived in New York, then maybe there would have been enough Jewish, political, critical that it would have kept me here. But being that in Minnesota was a little thin. And so that kind of also pulled me to Israel. But I was always in the peace movement. I mean, I was never a real Zionist. And I went, and I was from the very beginning active on the left. But in those days, Israel was a different place. It had a socialist government. The occupation hadn't taken root. We all thought the occupation would end sooner rather than later. So, you really had the idea that you were coming into a place that had progressive elements and you could help put the Middle East back together again in a certain way, be a part of that project. Today, somebody like me wouldn't even visit the country, let alone move there. But in those days, it was a little bit of a different context.
I remember you saying, and maybe I'm projecting, but I have a memory of you saying that something like, you didn't feel like you could go to Kenya.
That's right.
Because if you did that, felt some license. It wasn't that you didn't think that there was anything.
That's right.
That everything Israel was doing was okay, but you felt like you going there would be different from going to another country where you were kind of...
In another country, I would have been an expat.
Yeah.
Like I have a friend. I did work in Kenya, in Ethiopia, in Costa Rica. And I have a good friend from college I'm still in touch with who moved to Paris when I moved to Jerusalem. And I always wonder who made the better decision. I could have been 40 years in Paris by now. When you married a French woman and his kids are French, but he's an expat. He's not going to get up and tell the French how to vote with his accented French. And I'm in a different situation in Israel where I can be fully a part of the political scene.
Right. I mean, it's kind of subversive, right? Because it's a scene that's not, it's an apartheid state, as you call it, right? But it's one where you happen to have some
the
access
privilege.
And membership and privilege.
That's right.
But
that's
you're
right.
Using it not to, your point exactly. is to undo that element of it.
Exactly. We use our privilege in order to change things and push things and resist things in ways that Palestinians can't, or it's difficult for them.
Right. So, has you're part of the you founded the Israeli Coalition Against Housing Demolitions, and now you're working on a one democratic state solution. Can you talk about that trajectory and what you think is kind of the answer to what's going to happen, where Israel is going to go? all these really simple questions that are even even easier than what your name is.
Yes. Well, I, you know, I've been involved with the Israeli peace movement for more than 40 years. You know, for many years, the end game was the two-state solution. I mean, we accepted that, the Palestinians accepted that already in 1988, if not before. And so, you know, we did all our work politically with that kind of goal in mind. But with the Oslo peace process, you know, even though that was the agenda, you know, by the time we started our Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions in 1997, the Oslo process was in a state of collapse. Rabin had been assassinated in November 95. Netanyahu had been elected the first time in 96 with a, on an explicitly anti-Oslo program. And it was clear that the occupation was reasserting itself. It wasn't going to end. And we had, as the Israeli peace movement, to re-engage in resisting the occupation, which we began to do. We focused on the issue of house demolitions as a very powerful way of giving people an insight into how the occupation works, what Israel's intentions are, the human cost of occupation. Until today, I have to say, so far the count is about 55,000 Palestinian homes that have been demolished by Israel since 1967, only in the occupied territory. Thousands more have been demolished and are still being demolished inside Israel itself, including, of course, the about 60,000 homes that were demolished during the Nakba in 1948. So we're talking about a massive impact on a small society. And that was very powerful, but we were lacking, we've been lacking for the last 20 years. I mean, I would say the two, first of all, I would say the two-state solution never existed. Period. I mean, maybe in hindsight we see that, but Israel as a settler colonial movement was a unilateral movement to take over the country. It had no intention of recognizing the indigenous population, giving the indigenous population a state or any kind of sovereignty. It wasn't in the cards. But even discussion of it, even the possibility of it, was over with the end of the Oslo process in the year 2000. You know, by that, in 1993, when Oslo began, there were 200,000 settlers, which was still a pretty massive population in the Palestinian territories. 7 years later, when it ended, there were 400,000. So it's clear that the intention was not to detach the West Bank and Gaza and make it a separate state. Today, there's almost 800,000 Israelis living in the Palestinian territory. So the point is, you can't be in a political struggle without an end game. You're not an actor. You can protest, you can resist, you can have a campaign, but you're not really an actor if you don't have a political goal and a program. And so it's in, only in the last couple of years, in the last 2 years, that a number of us, I would say a core group of maybe 50 Palestinians, and maybe 20-some Israeli Jews have gotten together to try to formulate a program of a one-state solution. I have it even here. We have a 10-point program that I think is a very good program that bridges that gap. And that's what we're trying. We're going to launch probably in April as an actual movement. We call ourselves the One Democratic State Campaign. The idea is basic. Well, I won't get into the whole thing now, but the idea is basically to transform the one apartheid state that Israel created, that exists today, into a democratic state of equal rights for all its citizens, which shouldn't be such a shocking idea for Americans. And that's the idea, not to destroy anything. It's inclusive. You know, it's really a win-win approach for everybody, but it's one in which everyone gets equal rights in the country, the refugees return, and we begin to build a new civil society. That's kind of the idea of our movement.
I think in order to kind of understand that program, which it'd be great to return to what that will look like, something that I think a lot of people don't realize is why Israel is supported the way it is, because as you said, There's so many things. There's the Christian Zionists, there's AIPAC, there's guilt about the Holocaust. But as you put it in your book or in a talk you gave, guilt about the Holocaust doesn't determine Ireland's like agenda.
Yeah.
They're a country, as you point out, that understands colonialism very well.
That's right.
And so I think lots of times in the United States, we get kind of seduced or distracted because we're like, and this is exciting. Look, popular opinion is turning. It's no longer a third rail issue. You're allowed to criticize Israel without being called an anti-Semite or a self-loathing Jew. People still do that, but it's no longer, or, you know, like Peter Beinart did that study about young Jews choosing liberalism over Zionism, and everyone's freaking out. Who's a hawker Zionist is freaking out. Everyone else is celebrating, but none of that totally matters. Like that somewhat of creates the environment. But can you talk about what you discovered when you were looking at why this occupation was still around in terms of the role of Israel in the arms business?
Yeah, the question that Katie brings up, in a sense, how does Israel get away with this? Is the question I open my book with, War Against the People. You know, this is a conflict, or I would argue it's not a conflict, but it's a settler colonial takeover, of the last 100 years, you know, with an occupation of 50 years, you know, tremendous human rights violations, dozens of UN resolutions are ignored, brutality on the southern border of Europe. So it's very visible. It's in the news all the time. It isn't in some faraway corner of the world. A Jewish country doing it, no less, in the Holy Land. You've got all these elements together. And yet Israel gets away with it. In other words, its international position, at least among governments, not necessarily among the people, that's true. But among governments, its position improves all the time. And so that was the question I was trying, one of the questions I was trying to get at. How does Israel get away with this? And I decided to, instead of looking down at the occupation, to look up at Israel's place in the world. I have an amazing map that I would show if we had a PowerPoint here. And that is that Israel has a military, security, police relationships with virtually every country in the world, even countries that with which it has no diplomatic ties, like Saudi Arabia is probably the best example of that. So that, I won't get into the whole theory of it all, but you know, there's two levels. First of all, Israel has what I call technologies of repression. So they're able, if you're an elite or a government, especially if you're not popular among your people, Israel will give you the tools to repress and control your populations. We see that in Egypt, you know, very, very strongly in other places. But there's a bigger level, and that is global capitalism. I mean, we all live in a neoliberal capitalist regime that's closing down fairly rapidly. 80% of people in this world live on less than $10 a day. You have an Occupy movement because even the young people in the middle classes in the global north are being excluded more and more. They can't get jobs, there's no job security, they can't get housing, they have no prospect of achieving the living standards of their parents. And as the whole thing closes down and people are marginalized, and the world is being destroyed, and wars today are resource wars. Wars are against the people. You don't have wars anymore of governments, of states against states, really, armies against armies. The last major interstate war involving two or more powers was the Korean War. So that essentially wars today are resource wars, counterinsurgency, homeland security type thing against immigrants, against poor people, against restless middle class people, against people in the global south that are trying to protect their resources, to protect their sovereignty. And in the wars against the people that are really capitalist wars, the United States, that is the major power to try to, that's keeping the capitalist system going, does not have the proper weaponry. You know, F-35s are very good weapons if you're fighting the Soviet Union. They're not very good weapons if you're fighting the Occupy movement in New York, or the southern border with Mexico, or you know, the wars against the people anywhere. And Europe also doesn't have the proper weaponry. So Israel, what I'm trying to say is that Israel becomes a go-to state. It isn't that Israel's the only player, of course, but Israel is the only major industrial, highly sophisticated, high-tech country that's been fighting a war against the Palestinian people for the last 125 years. And it has a laboratory. If you have, you look at the West Bank and Gaza as really a laboratory, that you have millions of people at your disposal, literally, with no oversight. You can do anything you want to with them. You experiment. You can't explain the attacks on Gaza, these massive attacks, disproportional attacks, on the basis of the actual military threats. The only way you can explain it, and I talk about it in my book, is that new weapon systems, security systems, surveillance systems, systems of control are being experimented on and perfected on the Palestinians and then being exported. So Israel's, I call it global Palestine. So that in effect, Israel becomes maybe the major player in terms of the enforcement of global capitalist hegemony. You know, both in terms of individual countries that rely on Israel for these technologies, but also globally. And that's the quid pro quo that I'm trying to get at. In other words, Israel will deliver for you, and in return, you give it a pass in terms of the occupation. You know, so Israel's allowed to keep everything and keep its international standing. You can criticize Israel, that's fine. We don't mind. And as a matter of fact, it's even good, because it makes it look like we're really being challenged and people don't like us and we're victims. I mean, that all feeds into the process. As long as there's no sanctions, and there's never been sanctions on Israel by the UN or by any government. And so that's really, in a sense, the thesis of war against the people.
Which raises the question of the role of BDS, of course.
Right.
What does that achieve? What could that achieve? Is it a good strategy? There's a bit of a left-on-left anti-Zionist on anti-Zionist debate about this with, you know, Chomsky and Finkelstein.
I'm not sure
if they still are saying this, but thinking it's not a good strategy.
Right.
They have no moral opposition to it.
Well, both Norman and Noam are still two-state people.
Right.
For reasons it's hard to explain, maybe, but so from that point of view, I suppose BDS is seen as demonizing one side, or I don't know what exactly their problem with it is. I mean Chomsky, I know I've talked with him. He says you just have to work with the American Congress. That's the only player, which I think is kind of silly in some ways. I mean, I think it's one thing you have to work with, but you're not going to change the American Congress by itself without changing public opinion and all. At any rate, it doesn't matter. We've always supported BDS, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, our organization. Even before it was called BDS, we had a call to sanction Israel before even the BDS campaign. So we've always supported it. But I have two problems with the BDS campaign as it's run. One is, of course, the main problem is that it's become a standalone enterprise. In other words, it's a tool that should be connected to an end game. When we boycotted South Africa, it was always the end game. That one person, one vote, that's where we're going in South Africa, and that's what all the boycott activities were about. Here, we're doing BDS activities, boycotts, divestment, sanctions, without a purpose. Why are we BDSing? I mean, we can always delegitimize Israel. We can open space for criticism with BDS. We can get people involved. I mean, that's all good, but it's not a standalone project. It has to be connected to an end game. The second problem is, of course, in my view, is the targeting. I don't think the targeting is good. I don't like the Hewlett-Packard targeting, Motorola, SodaStream. It's not that these aren't good targets, but you know, you've got to explain so much. It's so tenuous, the tie. You know, I'm in favor of trying to get the American government to stop military relations with Israel. Stop corporations in your city from doing research with Israel. Stop your universities like CUNY from having a relationship with the Technion, which is the IDF's laboratory of military technologies. In a sense, it's come late, but the JVP's Deadly Exchange Program is where I would go to show how the occupation is here in your community. JVP, Jewish Voice of Peace, has a program called Deadly Exchange in which they're trying to show how Israel has penetrated the American police forces in terms of training, in terms of arming the police forces, bringing them to Israel, and so on, in order to bring out that that element of it. That's a good campaign. But again, it has to be tied to an end game. And that's where we come back to our movement. And that is hopefully, you know, in the next few months, as our program comes out, and we have, you know, we've been trying to sign people, Palestinians and Israeli Jews, as endorsers. We have several hundred signatures already. So people
probably
see
get McNally Jackson too.
Right. So people see who we are and everything. That then I think if we can get this going with a major Palestinian voice, this one state program, then we'll have to come to the BDS movement, come to the Jewish Voice of Peace, come to the U.S. campaign, to different Palestinian solidarity groups, churches, and so on, and say, okay, we expect you now to link your Palestine support activities to an actual political program. And that's going to be the next stage. And hopefully, if we can do that, that gives a certain direction and vision and program, a whole political purpose to all the different campaigns and activities that we're doing today.
Yeah. Can you reveal a little bit of what this program will look like?
Yeah, I can say it's a 10-point program. And one of the things we agreed upon was that we would really try to develop a program that could genuinely be brought forward in the political arena. In other words, I can sit down, I can close my eyes now and make up a program that the left would like. I have all the buzzwords. I know exactly. I could do it in a minute, and my five friends would agree with me. The question is, how can we develop a program that takes into account the different parties and the processes, that is just, that's a very strong, clear program, but that actually we could use, you know, that we can gain support in the international political system, not so much among Israelis maybe, but among some Israelis. And that's what we've tried to do. So let me just, 3 points out of the 10, maybe 3.5.
If we're lucky.
One is, we're talking about a constitutional democracy. One person, one vote, one parliament, equal individual rights for everybody, a liberal democracy that's based on citizenship, a country that belongs to its citizens, which is how the United States, I mean, I know it's ideal and there's racism, I'm not saying that, but in concept, the United States is a country like other European countries that belong to their citizens, rather than a country that belongs to an ethnic group or a national group or a religious group. In other words, to turn Israel-Palestine from what Israel is, which is an ethnocracy, a country that belongs to one particular group, just look at the flag and you can see that, into a Western democracy. So that's one point. The second point I want to mention is the right of return. The right of return is absolute. Refugees and the descendants. There's no question about it for Palestinians. You can't get anywhere without that. But it's not only a right, because I think what our plan does is it reveals a political logic that's very compelling. And that is that if the state is based on its citizens, on a citizenry, refugees are a part of that citizenry. I mean, the fact that you fled your country in a conflict or you were driven out doesn't mean you lose your civil status. So in a sense, the idea of bringing everybody home again, to the citizen, bringing the citizenry back and reconstituting the country, you know, has to include the refugees. They have, you know, it's a proper political process. It isn't only, well, they have rights and we have to bring them back. But they are a part of the citizenry. Third point, and this is the hardest point, actually. We talk about individual rights, collective rights. In other words, unlike the United States, you know, in the Middle East and in most of the world, ethnic groups, national groups, tribes, clans, religions have all preceded the state. The state is a sort of a new phenomenon, obviously. And so we have to acknowledge, we're not talking about Kansas, you know, a bunch of voters. We have to acknowledge these collectivities that are in the country and give them their space. So the idea is a multicultural democracy. In other words, there'll be equal rights, you know, in one country, one polity, but that you can speak your language. Nobody's going to stop you from speaking Hebrew or Arabic. You can have the Hebrew University. You can have your literature. You know, refugees can come back as Palestinians and then integrate into society. So it's very much like here. I mean, you have that here. You can be Amish. You can be a Satmar Hasid in Brooklyn. You can be, you know, you can be in a closed community if you want to be, or simply integrate into American society. You don't have to say that here, because that's a part of your individual rights and rights of association. But there, you know, with all the competition and the distrust and the history, we have to be very clear that all the collectivities that are there can stay, that this is inclusive. It's not against anybody. And now there's some Palestinians that reject that. You know, they feel that recognizing the collective rights of Israelis legitimizes Zionism or legitimizes settler colonialism. So there is another group that's parallel to us that we work with, but it is different, that rejects the idea of collective rights and says simply one person, one vote. The problem with that, of course, is one of the problems is that the Israeli Jews will be the minority in the country. They're already the minority between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River. So the Israelis aren't stupid. You know, they say, what's going to prevent the Palestinian majority in parliament from doing to us what we do to them today? The tyranny of the majority. And so we have to make it that there's a constitution and that parliament has no authority to pass laws to discriminate against any community. That's it. It's a safety net. So it doesn't give anybody any privileges. It doesn't cost the Palestinians anything, but it kind of reassures the Israelis. And that's one of the mechanisms I'm talking about where we can move this forward. and the last point I want to make is that once we dismantle and decolonize, dismantle these structures of domination and create a level playing field, the idea is that then we'll be able to develop over the course of 2, 3, 4 generations, a new civil society. In other words, the nice thing about collective rights is that they're very fluid. If this was a binational state, everybody would be locked into an identity. This way, you can choose how much you want to be in your community, how much you want to be integrated into a wider society. And over the generations, just from the daily life, daily experiences, living together, working together, sharing a common political system, a new civil society will emerge. that we don't have today. You know, we don't have a name for the country. That'll have to emerge. You know, there's this joke about that. What would the country be called that's inclusive? And, you know, you can call it Palestine if you spelled Stein, S-T-E-I-N. But anyway, that says something, the fact that there isn't an overarching civil identity, and that would have to emerge. And that's kind of the idea. You know, it cuts through a lot of issues, and I think it's very compelling, with a very compelling political logic. Yeah.
Well, I have more questions, but I thought that because there's so many people here to see you and you're not in town for a long time, we could open it up to questions and then maybe I'll abuse my power to ask some more. But how do we want to do this, McNally people, in terms of where they ask the questions from?
I can pass microphones.
Great.
If you're willing to do that.
Oh, so you're recording it as part of it?
Just so everybody can hear.
Oh, I have a big voice. I don't need a mic. That's why I was asking if you're recording it. So, first, a compliment. The way you describe Israel's influence in the rest of the world is a perfect description of what used to be called the American Empire, but is now a global, corporate, neoliberal economic empire. And just the U.S. Armed Forces happen to be used as the enforcers of it, but it's no longer an American Empire. But here's my question. I read your section on the electronic warfare weapons. There was one missing. So the U.S. Army has a active denial system that they can direct towards a group of civilians, peaceful or violent, and when they turn it on, their skin feels like it's on fire.
That's right.
And they'll run like hell.
That's right.
This weapon's been in existence for a number of years, and I'm wondering if they've given it to Israel to use the Palestinians as guinea pigs. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that effect, but I think this crowd and most Americans don't know that those weapons could very easily be turned on American civilians, especially since Obama signed the National Defense Authorization Act, which allows the Army to operate domestically.
That's right. And that's my point, is that the Palestinians are the guinea pigs. And the they're just the middle level. I mean, the weapons, you're on the receiving end, because Israel's not exporting the weapons to the Palestinians. You know, it's not making money or political capital on the Palestinians. They're simply the guinea pigs in the laboratory, and you're the customers, or your police forces are the customers, your security. And you see that certainly with the militarization of the police. That's what this deadly exchange program is about. You discover all kinds of things. You know, I was in Georgia State University in Atlanta giving a talk, and the students pointed out a building right out the window. It's called the Gillie Center. You should look it up, G-I-L-L-E-E, the Georgia International Law Enforcement Exchange Center, something like that, which is a black box on the campus of Georgia State University. Nobody can go in. Nobody knows what goes on inside. And it's an Israeli police training academy, where they all the American police from all over the country go there for training, and they bring them, and if you look it up, they do have a website, and if you look it up, you see all these pictures of American police at the Knesset and the Israeli police departments, and it's funded by Home Depot, or by the guy, by Bernard Marcus, the guy that started Home Depot. The Israel weapons industry, which makes the Uzi submachine gun, which is the most famous submachine gun of all, just opened a plant in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, for American law enforcement and for the 300 million gun nuts in this country, which is a huge market. And what they're doing is they're taking these military weapons that they produce, the Uzi, Galilee rifles, assault rifles, and so on, and compressing them into weapons that can be used by law enforcement or by civilians. So the Uzi is now a pistol. So the next time your local policeman pulls you over, he could easily be pulling a Uzi submachine gun out of a holster. So this is all part of the militarization of the police that Israel plays a tremendous role in, including restructuring your police departments. Because Israel's peddling the idea of a security state in which there's no more you know, these firewalls between the FBI and the CIA and local police and the FBI and all these different jurisdictions are all broken down. And the military and domestic security and police all work as one unit, like in Israel, which is the only Western country that works that way. And it's trying to use, for example, the Association of Chiefs of Major American Police Forces as a lobby in Washington for this. There's all kinds of levels. So this is really an issue. And this is what I'm saying about BDS. The more we can tie the BDS to what's happening here with your local police, for example, the more we can make the case that the occupation is here at home. And you know, I often say that as your police force is being Israelized, you're being Palestinianized. You know, so you're actually becoming Palestinians from the point of view of being on the receiving end of these technologies. The specific question about aerial denial technologies, Israel doesn't use these kind of microwave things. And there's other ones as well. You know, Israel helped develop the sonar one that makes a sound that you just can't stand that. But it doesn't use that. I think it's maybe used it once, but it doesn't use that as well. Israel uses instead, first of all, Israel uses live ammunition instead of aerial denial stuff. And then it's developed its own arsenal. You have skunk, which is a terrible smelling kind of a thing. And you've got a kind of a material that makes the ground like glass, you know, very slippery and people fall down. You've got a lot of nausea things that were, and in fact, in Belin, you know, Belin is this Palestinian community by the wall that's been fighting for years against the wall. You know, Five Broken Cameras is the film that comes out of that. They've collected in Belin a couple hundred canisters of all different kinds of crowd control devices, powders, sprays, all kinds of these things, because in fact it's like a laboratory. You know, the Israeli army knows at 10 o'clock every Friday morning there's going to be a group of Palestinians and maybe some Israelis and internationals, and companies are there, both American companies. American military units and Israeli companies are there to experiment with their crowd control devices. And one Palestinian fellow collects every week the canisters and has a whole display of a couple hundred canisters. So that, I would think that that's really, in a sense, what's happening more. And that is that you see it with Jenin, you see it with Gaza, you see it with Belin. That in fact, the controlling the Palestinians isn't the problem, but they're using all different kinds of controls as experiments that then go into the marketing.
So the one I described is the only one they're not using.
It's one of the only ones that they're not using, yeah.
There's another question here. If we can pass the mic. Or...
Thank you. It's my understanding that when South Africa did away with apartheid, there were certain deals that were made just to get on with the reconciliation process, where a lot of the central banking functions remained in the hands of the same people who had persisted throughout apartheid, and that's created some persisting problems afterwards. I noticed that the seventh point of your 10 points is economy and economic justice, but I just wondered if you could say a bit more about what lessons have been learned about what hasn't gone well after apartheid in South Africa?
Look, we have to flesh out a lot of these. I mean, these are, right now it's kind of, they're almost bullet points. So the more political ones are more thought out. Other ones like the economy and the land regime and things like that still have to be worked out. It's a problem because we obviously, I think all of us behind this program would like to see some kind of a socialist economy. Unfortunately, the vast majority, I think, of Palestinians and Israelis together would prefer a neoliberal economy. So, as a matter of fact, I even think, somebody asked me once, what would happen to this whole Israeli military industry? And I think the depressing answer is, I think the Palestinians would be more than happy to integrate into that industry. So that has to be kind of fleshed out. But the difference, of course, is that the Palestinians have a lot of resources that would, once the playing field is leveled, I think they'll achieve an economic parity fairly quickly. Shir Hever, who's an Israeli political economist who writes about the occupation, points out a lot of complementarity between the Palestinian economy and the Israeli economy. The Palestinian economy is suppressed, obviously, but that, you know, it's based on an educated population. There's a very vibrant high-tech telecommunications sector of the Palestinian economy. There's a lot of Palestinians in universities today. And, of course, the Palestinians have a diaspora that is actually no less wealthy and no less educated than the Jewish diaspora that kicked in for Israel. So I think, you know, again, given a level economic playing field, that they could achieve a parity fairly quickly. They're not as dependent, and they're certainly not as dependent as South Africa was on the World Bank and financing massive housing and land redistribution, all these things. You know, South Africa, of course, was required to pay the debts of the apartheid regime. So it never had the extra money for its own projects. You don't have that in Israel-Palestine. I think it's an easier issue to deal with economically, even though we still have to go through a process of trying to, whatever political system we come up with that we suggest, is going to be a minority one, and we're going to have to try to fight for it, I think.
It's funny, that question you asked about, that you raised, where you said that probably if there were a one-state solution, mm-hmm. it wouldn't be like all these formerly disenfranchised, persecuted people would then have rights and use those to stand in solidarity against the arms industry, yeah. Right?
Unfortunately.
And it's funny because it reminds me of lots of people like, well, if there's one state, like, or two state, people who are just anti-Palestinian, they'll be like, well, what if we give them rights and then they impose Sharia law or something? You know, to have this Islamophobia. Well,
right.
But it's funny because this is like the other side of that question. Of course, it's a lot more, I think, kind of relevant mm-hmm. or likely. But it is this hard thing because what are you really fighting against and fighting for, right? So you're kind of using the arms industry and the nanosecurity state mm-hmm. industry as a narrative to rightly provoke outrage and awareness about mm-hmm. what Israel's doing, right? But then ultimately, hopefully, then you have a one state and that's still there, but mm-hmm. then you just work on it as a one state. And I'm not being like dismissing the human rights in the present moment. It's mm-hmm. not like, oh, mm-hmm. why should we care about this if we still have mm-hmm. nano arms technology? I don't care. It's all superficial if these people have rights. Obviously, like the daily lives of Palestinians are important mm-hmm. and relevant, mm-hmm. and that's a goal unto itself. But is that what it would look like? We'd have more, there'd be a one-state solution with equal rights and equality. And then from there, you would, mm-hmm. let's say you wouldn't have to work on the housing demolitions, right? In theory.
That's right.
You know, that's not an issue. And then you can focus more mm-hmm. on the arms stuff and like the death exchange programs mm-hmm. and stuff. Like what does it even look like?
Yeah, I mean, the, liberation of Palestine, if you want to put it that way, or the creating this one equal state, is kind of almost a local issue. I mean, that has to do with Palestinians and Israelis and trying to rectify an unjust, oppressive situation. And it would have some impact in terms of the wider Middle East, maybe. Well, at least we hope so. But, you know, it wouldn't have the impact on the global system that so that in a sense, you know, this book War Against the People is something else. It's saying It's using Israel and the occupation and its repressiveness to open a window in terms of wider global processes. But I don't know. I hope I'm wrong. Maybe I'm being cynical or whatever. But my feeling is that a new one state with everybody together, country, would not change tremendously the economic structure of the country. I think the Palestinians would integrate into the military part of it. Maybe the military part would go down because there's no, you know, in other words, Israel could retool into other aspects of high tech, you know, which it already has to some degree, except the military is such a powerful incubator of, you know, because the military has the funds, the military has the laboratories, you know, that high-tech companies really don't. The military brings the technology up to a certain level that then the commercial companies can and the corporations can use. So, you know, I guess the downside for the Israeli or Israeli-Palestinian military industry would be you don't have any more wars. You know, peace is a problem if you have a war-based economy. You know, and I think the Israelis and Palestinians together would be very, really be a power in terms of high-tech development. So maybe there'd be less of an Israeli, you know, the global Palestine part would maybe be reduced to some degree. Maybe Israel wouldn't be anymore the go-to country for that kind of repression. But I still think there would be a fairly vital military industry, you know, and the military and high tech are just they're really the same industry, and so you know, the going back and forth is very natural. So I think in terms of wars against the people, the emergence of one state in Israel and Palestine might reduce to some degree the profile of the Israeli military in the world, but I don't think it would eliminate it. And I don't know if it would have a tremendously fundamental change in that situation.
Right. So then if this, and it's funny, it's like a new problem, right? God forbid, but if only. So if you had this one state, then it would kind of shift, and the kind of overtly egregious things that Israel does to Palestinians now wouldn't be on as display mm-hmm. as much, right? It wouldn't right. happen. As
Hopefully,
much.
It wouldn't oh, happen at all.
Right, at all.
That's right.
And so you have to make sure you like get a lot out of it now. Luckily, there's a lot of material, but in terms of documenting it. But then, Israel is kind of. It's interesting because I think Israel's an outlier in terms of what, it, like you said, gets away with, and it's not just because of guilt over the Holocaust, but as you know, you all know, and the Marxists all know, and superstructure and all that stuff, obviously, and like the cultural apparatus stuff that. Ideological mm-hmm. state apparatus stuff that Althusser wrote about. Like, there are all these ideologies and things that are used to forward the goals of the state or that's of right. the of industry, right? So an interesting thing with Israel that we see is that they really were trailblazers kind of in weaponizing identity politics in a way that was not just like weaponizing them mm-hmm. and in a way that didn't really have anything to necessarily do with, like in a way that co-opted them, but weaponizing them in a way to do the exact opposite of what they're grounding themselves in, right? Which is like, we had very, very terrible things happen to us. We're persecuted. Therefore, we are going to persecute these other people. It's not just like, oh, they're wasting it on some neoliberal agenda. Mm-hmm. It's actually mm-hmm. perpetuating, suffering, inflicting suffering on other people. And I think that gives Israel a very unique narrative. And it definitely stifles some potential critics. Mm-hmm. But I remember actually talking to Juan Cole, who's he's a Middle Easternist. Yeah. I don't know what the academic.
Michigan,
yeah. I thought you said Michigas at first. But I remember talking to him saying something about how unique Israel is because of its founding, the Holocaust. And he was like, no, it's not really unique. It's just a question of chronology. And he was like, mm-hmm. every nation is founded by exterminating or displacing the people that are there. Mm-hmm. And it has every nation when it's founded has an origin story that justifies it. And it was interesting because I as a New York lefty Jew, of course, I'm am like very eager to find the particular pathology that I think is there, and I feel like almost a burden and duty to speak about, because other people, when they do, they'll be called anti-Semites, and I'm fine with being called a self-loathing Jew. But then at the same time, you have this, you know, this wokeization, where Israel loves saying that, well, we're the only place, and we saw this during the Democratic Platform Committee meetings, where a Clinton appointee was saying that we shouldn't call the occupation because Tel Aviv is the only city in the Middle East, she said, where I can walk around holding my wife's hand. And Jim Mazzagwi, who's Lebanese American, responded like, that's great, I can't even get through the airport when I go to Israel. And there's such a, like, especially to people who pay attention to this and the misuse of and hijacking of identity politics, there's such trailblazers in this, in a way. It's like they have such great, it's called pinkwashing too, right? They do a lot of pinkwashing, like, look how great it is to be LGBT in Israel.
And there's greenwashing.
Right, greenwashing, making the desert. The rainbow washing, exactly. That's how LGBTQ friendly it is, rainbow. And so we can see how all of this is both part of the conversation, needs to be part of the conversation, but it's also like, it's not about that, it's about the arms. And it's about the security state. And that gets kind of neglected in most of the narratives about
You know, again, I think these are two separate things. And I'm hoping, just to reiterate that, we've gone beyond ideology to some degree. I mean, that's one of the problems with neoliberalism, is that it's squelched any kind of ideology to some degree, so that the resolving this, the Arab-Israeli conflict, as it's called, is not going to resolve a lot of the basic issues of socialism in the Middle East or being progressive in the Middle East. We kind of have an expectation of Palestinians as a progressive, maybe even socialist, revolution, we talk about liberation, the Palestine Liberation Organization. But, when we were trying to, to formulate our program, we went to the Palestinian Constitution because we wanted to make our program as close to what's already been accepted by Palestinians, for themselves as much, and we couldn't use it. The Palestinian Constitution, the PLO, was a secular organization, and they always talked about a secular state. But if you look at the Palestinian Constitution, it's actually based on Islamic law. Yeah, but I remember the Christian community being very upset about that. The point is that I think there was a, even though the PLO was a secular organization, when it actually came to constructing a Palestinian state, it went to Islamic law. And those are, in other words, I think the fight for a progressive society in Israel, Palestine, and the Middle East is not going to end with the establishment of a single state. That state is still going to need a lot of work, and we're still going to have a lot of struggles.
Do you have anything on it? Comment or question, because
you
seem to be a...
Stephen Sheehy is a professor at William & Mary, so he's of Middle East studies. So he has a certain authority. Yeah. So you want to say?
No, I think it's hard to, if we talk about the Democratic State movement, it's going to be hard to gain purchase from Palestinians and occupation in Gaza and in West Bank. If you can't envision that transition as an alleviation of the misery that they feel daily,
that's
which
right.
includes an economic desperation,
right.
Political oppression,
that's right.
The occupation, as you know, saturates life, but also in zone A. So there's
you know, nepotism, corruption of the prosecuting authority. So if you, and this is the conversations I've had about the one state possibility with Palestinians and West Bank, which is, if you are promising us to trade two ruling classes,
that's right,
for one unified ruling class, mm-hmm, and no conditions change, then it's not really an option.
Right.
So I don't know if I'm encouraged by the vision of saying, okay, we have one political unity that ensures the dominating class domination,
exactly,
the poor distribution of resources, and well, I mean, we have that in the United States.
That's
we could all just become Americans.
That's
kind of what you were saying.
That's right.
But then I don't also want to suggest that, like, because I, of course, not, I mean, it's not like there's been a really dangerous weaponization of that, well, I don't live there, I'm not from there, right? Because then people are like, listen to, it's like, okay, you want us, mm-hmm, to listen to certain ones, right? But so I was going to say that I also don't feel totally, it's easy for me here to be like, well, if we don't get to the root of the neoliberal meanwhile, like, kids are dying, being shot at, mm-hmm, and it's also hard to compare it, because of course it's horrible here in the United States, and there's police violence, and thanks in large part to Israel and, you know, our special, mm-hmm, relationship. Mm-hmm. Although that doesn't matter either, because they do it with Saudi Arabia. So,
right.
But it is, it's like, there is, I thought when you started talking, I thought you were going to say, from the people I've spoken to, they don't care about the class stuff. They just want to have, to stop, mm-hmm, being killed while they try to get to the hospital or something. That was just like, that's not relevant. Mm-hmm. I happen to think that. That has nothing, mm-hmm, to do with the reality. But that's what, so how do we balance those two things? So it doesn't feel, mm-hmm, like we're asking people to wait, like table that, the whole suffering thing, that's not just like what you're saying, trading up a different system of oppression and devastation, economic devastation and humiliation, but also be sensitive to the fact that there is this apartheid state, right? And I don't know, I have no idea what most people in that apartheid state want, living at the bad, mm-hmm, on the bad side, mm-hmm, of it.
I don't want to dominate the
conversation. But just, go ahead.
No, I would say, you know, one thing out of my conversations with folks in the West Bank is that they certainly don't want, I mean, there was a moment of hope with Oslo, even though a lot of us were just like, yeah, right. but folks don't want to fall into that trap the second time, right? I mean, and how people live in, now Israel is always pointing like, well, you know, it's the Palestinian Authority's problem or their fault, and the people in Gaza, it's because the Palestinian Authority is starting, so that I'm not saying that by any means, but Palestinians effectively, in many ways, live under two sets of occupations. One, the master occupation, because the end all and be all is Israel. Whether whatever zone you're in, you're under Palestinian, Israeli Zionist occupation, mm-hmm, and it affects you every day, whether you're inside the center of Ramallah, as we've seen recently, they can come in and go at will on a college campus, inside Palestinian controlled area, the head of the student union, the president of the student body, they come in with military force and take them out within Palestinian controlled area. So this is, you're absolutely right. But on the other hand, there's actually a sense of desperation, because those people who are supposed to be advocating for you, the Palestinian Authority, are so corrupt, are so actually already allied with, in many ways, the Israeli ruling class. And in fact, the Israeli ruling class had gone so deep and they can't even make these alliances anymore. So, I mean, it's very, very recent, until very recently, that they discontinued the security, all the sort of stuff that's happening. Jerusalem goes, you know, wherever, and the problem is that they're still in a security cooperation agreement. So, that's what I was just trying to mention. To intervene, that what is this? How does the one democratic state offer true change conditions on the ground for Palestinians?
That's right. And we haven't gotten there yet.
Right.
We're still focused on the political side, I think.
But you want to have that in mind, right? So that
of course we have to.
I'm not lecturing you like
that.
So I think there's another question, and then.
So you would say that, I mean, when you talk about end game, I mean, for us here in this room, for example, would you say that one of the most important things we could do would be to stop U.S. military collaboration with Israel through the kind of contracts you're talking about, or even just through the military packages, or would that make a difference? Would that help, or would that be a big step forward?
No, that would make a huge difference, of course. In other words, we're good at the BD, at the BD part. We're not very good at the S, which is sanctions. And sanctions are mainly governmental. And that's one level. The U.S. campaign does have, it's not really a campaign, it's sort of a, they do say we should stop, try to publicize how much money the United States gives Israel and say we should stop that. It's short of a full-fledged campaign, but at least they brought that up. But that would be, make a huge difference, of course, if that was a, you know, I mean, if that was a BDS target, the S, you know, sanction Israel, you know, don't buy their technologies, don't give them privileged access to American military technologies. That's really what gives Israel the edge in the market. Selling and buying arms and so on would be a tremendous thing. Even if it didn't happen, just simply raising that whole issue would open the discussion. There's one other thing, we talked about it a little bit before over dinner, actually, that could be a BDS kind of a target. And that is, you know, what Israel's doing in the occupation is illegal in international law. You know, there is an occupation that Israel denies, first of all. So that Israel says the Fourth Geneva Convention, which protects people living under occupation and limits the occupying power, and that Israel's in violation of every article of, is enforceable. It has sanctions connected to it. In other words, you don't just have to get unilateral American sanctions. International law that exists, that Israel violates, is there in place. And now, the problem is the way you enforce the Fourth Geneva Convention through sanctions, and even, you know, up to military intervention, is through the Security Council. Security Council has to pass. Well, that can't happen because of the American veto. And often in Security Councils, you've had votes of 14 to 1. So if there was a focused campaign on bringing a resolution before the Security Council that the Fourth Geneva Convention applies, and this could be an international campaign, especially in the countries that are members of the Security Council, you know, that the Fourth Geneva Convention applies and it should be enforced, and then have a concentrated campaign in the United States that the American government would not veto that. You see, that would, if something like that would happen, that would change the whole situation. You know, if in fact the international community was, or the UN was allowed to enforce the 14th Geneva Convention, especially through sanctions. So it isn't necessarily that you have to get the American government to sanction, but if you just got the American government just to let the UN do the dirty work, in a sense, I think that would make a huge difference. So that's another example of a BDS target and campaign that could be used that hasn't been used yet.
Can I just ask a corollary question to that?
Trump gives
you... Sarah Huckabee gives you two questions.
Okay. Well, I mean, because there's a lot of times people say, well, it doesn't matter, Israel's military is so strong they could get by without the United States. Military assistance. But if the United States really cut off its military assistance, it would make a big difference, wouldn't it, what Israel could do?
First of all, the United States gives Israel $4 billion a year, which would be a dent in Israel's budget have a big influence. More so would be if Israel was denied, like European countries are denied, privileged access to American military technology. You see, that's what, in a sense, that's what offsets the money part of it, because it's true, Israel has some resources, and it could, without the $4 billion, it could still do quite a bit. But without access to cutting-edge American military technology, Israel would be very hard-pressed to keep its high-tech industry at, you know, at the level that it is. So I think that that's, and that also, you know, could be a BDS target. It doesn't cost anything. And in a sense, you'd almost be equalizing Israel's relations to the rest of the world, because Europe, the United States' closest allies, don't have access to American military technology like Israel does.
Has Bernie Sanders fairly not at all scathing criticism of Netanyahu or Israel, has that changed anything? Do you think, has anyone felt emboldened by that?
No.
It's just...
He's not taken seriously, and I think Israel feels very confident in the American support that it has.
There's another.
Lara?
Lady in red. Exciting to get to say that. And then you're signing books, right?
I'm willing to
yeah,
sign
so
books.
Yeah, so after that, so if you have more questions.
But you have to buy them first.
Okay, so you gather around there.
Right,
so,
Nora?
Yeah, that's fine, yeah.
Okay.
So I'm a clinical psychologist by profession, and my work is on group processes, structural racism, decoloniality. So when I look at this, I can't help but okay. also think of that.
Good.
And 10 is a beautifully round number. But and I, you know, ideally, as I think about it this way, I let my sort of fantasy go to an ideal place of psychic reparations and psychic interventions that go alongside
mm-hmm.
a one democratic state,
right,
right? In the long term. And the greatest example of this is the United States, because you know, slavery is abolished, and we still see the wrecking effects of what happens and what lasts, and how colonial subjects come to internalize the colonial power, even after colonialism is done, so to speak. So the material realities aren't the only thing that are there, right? It's that lived experience, and when one is sort of infantilized, denigrated, consistently, systemically, these things have lasting effects that are centuries. And I think the only way to sort of truly see a future is to have these things exist together, right? So at, like you say that we make inroads with the BDS movement, I would also say make inroads with sort of mental health professionals
exactly.
and people who are doing these sorts of things, because there's no way truly structurally forward if we're not thinking about it in that
that's
way as
right.
well.
That's right.
I mean, I think our program reflects maybe to some degree the Palestinian priorities.
Mm-hmm.
First, let's deal with this occupation, with the political issues and, you know, house demolitions and all that stuff. Then let's get on, you know, maybe to economic things. And then, you know, let's get on to closure, reconciliations, healing, you know, including the right of return. We do relate to that to some degree in the thing about the right of return, of reintegrating. We're finishing, so let me, because, you know, the problem when you're working politically with an activist group is, I mean, I don't know how to say this without sounding stupid, but, you know, my advantage in my work is that I'm an academic. I have a PhD, I'm a professor, I'm an anthropologist, but I'm also an activist. And that's not a usual thing. So the people I deal with, put this together, are activists. Or people, you know, coming that are busy, that have jobs, that are coming to it. They're not academics. So sometimes it's hard to get this kind of a discussion going. This kind of an evening would be very hard to do with activists. They just don't have the patience for this, at least in our world, for these, some of these. I mean, maybe they would invite someone to come and talk for an evening, but to have an ongoing discussion and getting into these issues, is hard to do with activists. And on the other hand, the academics that have that tend to be disconnected from the activists. And so, you know, I think that's a process. But if I would just summarize the way I would do it, I'm not representing our group right now, but I hear you and I've tried to think that through. If this is a settler colonial situation, the only way to resolve it isn't through negotiations and compromise like a conflict, it's to decolonize. And that includes the psychic part and the closure. So I would see a process of three things. If I was asked, how do we end this whole thing? It seems to me there's three things that have to be done in mounting order of difficulty. First of all, the settlers, the Israeli Jews, have to acknowledge the existence of the indigenous population, of the Palestinians. Their existence, their national existence, and their narrative, and also their agency. Because what's happened is, even if Israel sat across the table with the Palestinians, Palestinians never had the right to say no or to present their own ideas. They had the right to say yes to what Israel wanted, or Israel's going to do this unilaterally. So that's one thing that's never been done. Israel has never recognized either the existence or the agency, the sovereignty of a Palestinian people. Then secondly is what we've talked about in this plan, a political system that dismantles the structures of domination, creates a level playing field, gives equal rights to people. In other words, you dismantle the structures of domination and control. And that's the more the political part. And then the third part, I think, gets into what you're talking about. The third part is the closure. And in a settler colonial situation, the only ones that can declare it over, that we have reached a post-colonial relationship where we can normalize and you settlers can be nativized in a way, that can only be done by the indigenous population. So this can only be resolved if the Palestinians, in a sense, recognize the Israelis. And so the third part of it is, and this is the hardest part, in order for that to happen, the settlers have to acknowledge the crimes they committed to the indigenous population and take responsibility for it. So if you do those three things, you acknowledge the existence and the rights and the agency of the indigenous, you dismantle the structures of domination and create a more egalitarian, inclusive political system, and you acknowledge and accept responsibility for the crimes that you committed, then there's kind of a deal. If you've done those three things, the indigenous then say, okay, you know, from our point of view, there's a closure here, you know, and we're willing now to declare that we're in a post-colonial situation and we can normalize relations with you. So that I think that's the hardest part, because for Israeli Jews and Zionists to acknowledge what they've done to Palestinians is harder than getting to one state politically. But I think if those three things happen, that's the recipe for decolonization. And then we can go on and normalize relations.
I would say there's an American version and the Israeli version of non-apologizing, which is like, so the Americans are like, no, okay, and this is the voice I'm hearing is the voice of certain girls I went to high school with, but it's like, no, like in 1948, like everyone wanted to go. They like all left on their own. Yeah. And I went to school on the Upper East Side. And then the Israelis are like, yeah, it was a ethnic cleansing, and if we had done more, it would be no problem today.
We never finished 1948.
Yeah. Right. And it's so, to me, I'm always like, I actually prefer, just in terms of conversation, the latter, because you're agreeing about the facts on the ground. Mm-hmm. You're just not agreeing about humanity. But it is funny, the different flavors that each one brings to it. So you may have to have different scripts in each country. Anyway, but thank you so much. Where can people find you and your work?
you can always write to me.
Okay.
I mean, I'm
don't, Pigeon.
I won't reply the same day, maybe, but jeffhalper@gmail.com. You know, we also have the One Democratic States campaign doesn't have a website yet. We're working on it. We have a Facebook page, One Democratic State Campaign. But ICAD, my organization, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, does have a website, so you can look us up and communicate that way. So thank you to McNally Jackson and Nora and everybody here, and to Katie, of course, and my non-relative, and to all of
all
you.
All the helpers who made this possible.
For having the evening.
Yeah, thank you. You can find me at Twitter @KTHelps, by the way, if you want. And I'll have you on my show, my podcast. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to The Katie Helper Show. You can always support The Katie Helper Show at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. And dropping soon will be a bonus episode with Adam Johnson, where we talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, representation in the media, and the Ilhan Omar controversy.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
This is Bayard Winthrop, founder of American Giant. I started this company because I was fed up with cheap clothes that didn't last and companies that shipped manufacturing overseas. We believed we could still make incredible clothing right here in the U.S. with American cotton and American workers earning real wages. That's what we stand for, making clothes that actually last. Get 20% off your first order when you use code GIANT20 at American-Giant.com.